Hey everyone, Sebastian here. Welcome to a little something I am calling an Our Fake History special presentation. Before I get into what that is, first I want to let everyone know that the baby has arrived. Yes, for those of you who've been following along with the various ins and outs of my life, my wife and I just welcomed our second child into the world, and we just could not be more excited. Both mom and baby are doing great, very healthy, very happy, and so I just wanted to thank everyone who sent along all their kind wishes and all their messages of love. It was really, really sweet. Thank you so, so much. We're just delighted over here at my house. Now, if you listened to the last episode, then you know I'm taking a small break from creating new material so I can be as present as possible for the growing family. But that doesn't mean that the feed is going quiet. Instead, you folks are going to get to hear something that I created a few years ago for my patrons. So, one of the perks that comes with being a patron is that every time we hit one of our Patreon fundraising goals, my patrons get to submit suggestions on what topic they would like me to cover for an exclusive episode. I pick my five favorite suggestions, and then I let the patrons vote on which one they would like me to create. Since we launched Patreon, I've done a few of these on top of all the other extra episodes and goodies that the patrons get. Over the years, the patrons have voted for episodes on Nikola Tesla, Vlad the Impaler, and today's topic, the Knights Templar. Now, I've decided to pull this particular episode out from behind the paywall because I get so many requests from listeners who aren't patrons to do an episode on the Knights Templar. Now, when I get a request like that, usually I direct that person to the Patreon page and say, hey, if you want to hear about the Knights Templar, think about becoming a supporter. But I think it's time that the wider audience heard my take on the Templars, because the Knights Templar are such an essential fake history topic. If you're interested in historical myths, misconceptions, and pseudo-history, the Knights Templar really can't be missed, so it only seems right that this one should be shared with the wider world. Now, I should also let you folks know that we are 94% of the way towards our next Patreon goal, and when we hit it, the patrons will once again get to vote on a topic for an all-new exclusive extra episode that just the patrons will get to listen to. So if you think that being a patron sounds like something you'd be into, then please go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory. So today, I have to thank my Patreon supporters for being very cool about me pulling this one out from behind the paywall. As I've said many times before, I owe you for this one. Now, when I make these extra shows for my patrons, they tend to be a bit longer than a typical episode of Our Fake History. The show that I created on the Knights Templar certainly was. So I've decided to present it here on the main feed in two installments. That's meant that I've had to make a few tweaks and edits so it will all make sense as a two-part experience. But I really think you're going to enjoy it. Now, with that said, there are still a few artifacts in this recording from when it was a one-part episode that was meant specifically for patrons. You're going to hear a few messages that were meant specifically for the patrons, and you're going to hear a few references to it being one big episode. Just, you know, remember that that was part of its original incarnation, and now you are hearing it in two parts. You get it. You understand how this stuff works. So today you are going to get part one of What Should We Believe About the Knights Templar? And then in 2 weeks' time, you will get part two of this series, where we will wrap the whole thing up. If you would rather listen to the whole thing in one uninterrupted ad-free blast, then one more plug for you folks. Please consider becoming a patron. After this special series wraps up, I will be back with brand new episodes of Our Fake History on March 22nd, 2022. All right, everyone, that's enough preamble. Enjoy part one of What Should We Believe About the Knights Templar. There's a novel by the great Italian writer Umberto Eco called Foucault's Pendulum. The book is a dense but often hilarious satire of the world of historical conspiracy theories. At one point, one of his characters gets into a bit of a rant about the different types of idiots. It's so good that it deserves to be quoted at length, so indulge me. Eco writes, quote, "There are four kinds of people in this world: cretins, fools, morons, and lunatics. Cretins don't even talk. They sort of slobber and stumble. Fools are in great demand, especially on social occasions. They embarrass everyone but provide material for conversation. Fools don't claim that cats bark, but they talk about cats when everyone else is talking about dogs. They offend all the rules of conversation, and when they really offend, they are magnificent. Morons never do the wrong thing. They get their reasoning wrong. Like the fellow who says that all dogs are pets, and all dogs bark, and cats are pets too, and therefore cats bark. Morons will occasionally say something that's right, but they say it for the wrong reason. A lunatic is easily recognized. He is a moron who doesn't know the ropes. The moron proves his thesis. He has logic, however twisted it may be. The lunatic, on the other hand, doesn't concern himself at all with logic. He works by short circuits. For him, everything proves everything else. The lunatic has a fixed idea, and whatever he comes across confirms his lunacy. You can tell him by the liberties he takes with common sense, by his flashes of inspiration, and by the fact that sooner or later, he brings up the Templars." End quote. Yes, sooner or later, a lunatic brings up the Templars. I love this passage. It very neatly summarizes my own frustrations when I'm reading the various pseudo-histories or online conspiracy theories that I have to look through for this show. In my opinion, most pseudo-historians are what Umberto Eco categorizes as morons. They get their reasoning wrong. They have logic, but it's twisted, and as a result, they arrive at weird conclusions. Occasionally, they will say something right, but as Eco says, it's for the wrong reasons. But every now and then, especially online, you come across a lunatic. Someone who can't change their mind and sees their conclusions confirmed in absolutely everything. These types tend to take conspiracy theory particularly seriously. And in the world of historical conspiracy theories, there is no greater catnip than the Knights Templar. Some of the best-known pseudo-historical works from the last 40 years focus heavily on the Templar Order. The various conspiracies associated with these medieval crusaders reached a new level of pop culture ubiquity in 2003 when The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown became an international phenomenon. Templar conspiracies, which had once been the realm of only the most dedicated enthusiasts, were now being discussed by everyone and their grandmother. I had a friend who once told me that around that time, they got on a subway car here in Toronto. As they looked around, my friend noticed that every person in the car who was reading a book was reading the same book. It was the Da Vinci Code. The book was that popular. So after 2003, nearly everyone had an opinion on the Knights Templar. But despite having a huge pop culture moment, the real history of the Templars still remains obscure to most people. Who were these warrior monks? How did they get their start? Why did they suddenly disappear? And why have they become such a fixture of historical conspiracy theories? Let's find out today on a very special extra episode of Our Fake History. Our Fake History Special Presentation, What Should We Believe About the Knights Templar, Part 1. Hello and welcome to a very special extra episode of Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. Now, if you're hearing my voice right now, then that means that you're one of my super amazing Patreon supporters. Hello, friend. You know me. I know you. I'm pumped that you're hearing this right now because that means that you are generous enough to support this show on a monthly basis. I know I say this all the time, but it's because of you beautiful human beings that my weird bedroom hobby has transformed into a legitimate second job. If you're hearing this, then that means that this show is important to you, or at least in a small way, and I am honored by that. I love you for that. I hope this little reward episode satisfies. The extras are going to keep coming, so stay tuned. But I hope this humble little offering is everything you hoped it would be when you cast your vote a few months ago. This topic took off to an early lead in the vote, and very soon it could not be caught. 52% of all respondents wanted a show on the Knights Templar. However, many of you did not vote. Despite my many calls to action, just over 50% of you voted, which I guess makes us a pretty typical democracy. But still, why not vote? It's so easy. If you're having a hard time figuring out the voting process, send me a message because, let your voice be heard. Nonetheless, the topic that the majority of voters wanted was the Knights Templar, so being a man of my word and a lover of democracy, I will honor the will of the voters. However, I have to say that I was a little concerned when you folks first chose this topic. The Knights Templar, or more properly, the Poor Fellow Knights of the Temple of Solomon, are one of the most mythologized religious orders in the history of Christianity. As a rule, these extras are one-and-done standalone episodes, and you guys chose a meaty topic. As a result, I've had to be strategic about what I'm going to focus on. I've decided that the best approach is to look at just the birth of the Templars, the death of the Templars, and the weird history of Templar conspiracy writing. Now, that means that I'm going to have to yada, yada, yada through a few hundred years of history, but honestly, it's worth it if we're going to get to the good stuff. If you want more context about the Crusades, then I would direct you back to the three-parter I did on the First Crusade in Season 3. It's all available in the archive at ourfakehistory.com. Still, there's a lot to cover in this episode, so buckle up, this is going to be the longest episode of Our Fake History in Our Fake History history. I know that sounded clunky, but I liked it. Being that you are the hardcore fans of the show, I figured you wouldn't mind a particularly long episode. So here it goes. All right, enough preamble. Let's head back to the end of the First Crusade and see what we can learn about the birth of the Knights Templar. The religious order of knights that became known as the Templars were created in the heady aftermath of the First Crusade. In 1099, after numerous false starts, double crosses, and near starvations, an army of Christians managed to conquer Jerusalem. The crusade had been called 3 years earlier, and at first, the plan was for Europeans to aid the Byzantine Empire. Any land that was recaptured by these crusading armies was supposed to be returned to the emperor. You see, the Byzantines, aka the Roman Empire, had governed the area before Islamic armies had invaded centuries earlier. However, as the crusade progressed and relations with the Byzantines soured, the European crusaders instead decided to create their own independent kingdoms in the lands they had recently conquered. These new Christian-run kingdoms would eventually become known to history as the Crusader States. The largest of the Crusader States was known as the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was obviously the capital, but at its peak, this kingdom encompassed what is today modern Israel, Palestine, and large portions of the modern countries of Jordan and Syria. It was in this kingdom that the Templars would come into existence. Now, as you might remember from my series on the First Crusade, one of the motivations for the Crusaders had been the perceived danger faced by Christian pilgrims in the Holy Land. In that series, I challenged the idea that Muslims were especially hostile to Christian pilgrims before 1096. I actually went out of my way to show that while the road to Jerusalem was undoubtedly dangerous, many of the so-called religiously motivated massacres were exaggerated or simply didn't happen. I also pointed out many instances when Christians were saved by Muslims from bandits. My goal was to bust a bit of a myth, that being that Islamic aggression against pilgrims is what got people crusading. However, it's worth pointing out that this situation changed dramatically after the First Crusade. After the Crusader armies successfully invaded the Holy Land and entrenched themselves in strongholds, the Muslim world became decidedly more hostile to Christians of all stripes. In the years directly following the conquest of Jerusalem, pilgrims started to be targeted specifically because they were Christian. Clerics in the Islamic world were actively calling on Muslims to attack Christian invaders. Unarmed pilgrims were now seen as part of the problem. Returning to this topic now, I realize that many of the poor historical sources that used Muslim massacres of pilgrims as a way to justify the crusade were often conflating attacks that happened in the years after the crusade with those that happened before. I know this might seem like I'm splitting hairs, but the timeline on this stuff is kind of important, especially if you're making a case for why a holy war was justified. For instance, there was one particularly violent attack on Christian pilgrims that often gets misremembered as happening before the First Crusade, but in truth, it happened after, and it was the reason that the Templar Order got founded in the first place. You see, after the conquest of Jerusalem, a new wave of Christian pilgrims started to flood into the Holy Land. One particular group of over 300 pilgrims, most of whom were German, made it to Jerusalem in time for Easter in 1119 AD. This group visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and also witnessed something known as the Miracle of the Fire. For those of you who don't know, this is a miracle that happens every year in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to this very day. A flame is said to spontaneously start emanating from Christ's tomb every year on Holy Saturday during Easter. Many non-believers have claimed that the entire thing is a carefully orchestrated piece of theater put on by the priests at the church. The famous 18th century historian Edward Gibbon once called it, quote, a pious fraud. But for those that follow the Eastern Orthodox tradition, it's still a big deal. To the pilgrims who witnessed the miracle in 1119, it was a huge deal. We're told that they were so overcome by religious zeal that they decided to organize an impromptu march to the River Jordan so they could bathe in the waters where Christ had been baptized. This proved to be a very bad idea. While things were quite safe inside the walls of Jerusalem, outside of the city, it was a very different situation. The pilgrims were on the road to the river when they were attacked by Muslim bandits. The attackers showed no mercy. By the time it was all over, 300 pilgrims lay dead and another 60 had been taken prisoner and were being held for ransom. The attack had been so shocking that the king of Jerusalem, a man named Baldwin II, felt the need to act. He sent out a posse of knights to apprehend the bandits, but by the time they had mustered, the attackers had long since fled to their various hideouts. It was in the aftermath of this attack, we're told that a French knight named Hugh de Pens approached King Baldwin and the Patriarch of Jerusalem for permission to start a new monastic order. This new order would be similar to the Knights Hospitaller. Those were the knights who operated the Hospital of St. John and who cared for injured pilgrims and crusaders in the Holy Land. However, unlike the Hospitallers, this new order would be explicitly concerned with the safety of pilgrims on the dangerous roads. These men would be monks, but they would also be warriors. In fact, their role as warriors would be far more primary to their identity than, say, the Hospitallers. Their job, first and foremost, was to be a bodyguard. This would essentially institutionalize the idea of the warrior pilgrim that had been created by the First Crusade. A warrior monk was a very natural extension of that. Hugh de Payen was granted his request by Baldwin II, and in 1119, the order was born. In 1120, in an attempt to get this still ragtag band of knights out of the now crowded Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Baldwin granted them a new headquarters. He gave them a building that had served as the palace of the Christian kings of Jerusalem after the conquest. It was a building on the Temple Mount, not far from the golden-roofed Dome of the Rock. This impressive structure had been known to the Muslims as the Al-Aqsa Mosque and had been built by them in 705 AD. Now, due to its impressive architecture and its location on the Temple Mount, the Crusaders took to calling this building the Temple of Solomon. Now, we should get this straight. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is not the Temple of Solomon. It was built near the spot we think the Temple of Solomon was, but this was not the same building. This is going to be important later on because this may be the first real piece of fake history that has to do with the Templars. So right off the hop, there's a misnomer. They call the wrong building the Temple of Solomon. Nevertheless, this was the new headquarters, and it gave the order its name. They were to be the Poor Fellow Knights of the Temple of Solomon, or the Knights Templar for short. As the name suggests, in the early days, the Brothers of the Knights Templar were not a particularly wealthy order. Despite their impressive headquarters, the early Templars were indeed poor fellows. An early seal for the order actually depicts two knights sharing one horse. The individual brothers took the typical monastic vows of chastity, obedience, and perhaps most ironic, given the later history of the brotherhood, poverty. When a brother took a vow of poverty, all that really meant was that he could not own any private property himself. The order, on the other hand, was completely free to accumulate huge amounts of wealth, and over the first century of its existence, the Templars did exactly that. The Templars also got an early boost from one of the 12th century's most well-known church intellectuals. This was Bernard of Clairvaux, the man who would eventually become canonized as Saint Bernard. Bernard of Clairvaux was a prolific writer and preacher. He was basically as close as you got to a religious celebrity in the medieval world. At some point between 1120 and 1136, the date's a little uncertain, Bernard wrote a widely circulated treatise about why the Knights Templar were a great new thing. It was called In Praise of the New Knighthood, and in it, Bernard provided a theological justification for the concept of warrior monks. You see, there were still lots of religious thinkers out there who believed that monks, who were supposed to emulate the example of Christ, shouldn't really be violent. In his treatise, Bernard pish-poshed that whole idea and found all sorts of scriptural justifications for a militant brotherhood. He also compared the Templars to the secular knights of the day, where he found typical knights to be vain, needlessly violent, and generally pointless. He found the Templars to be noble, fearless, and drawn to a higher calling. In Saint Bernard's opinion, if you were going to be a knight, you might as well be a Templar. Bernard of Clairvaux's stamp of approval did wonders to both legitimize and popularize the Knights Templar. Bernard also started championing the Templars at various church councils, and before long, the order had become one of Europe's most well-supported charities. The status of the Templars was given another huge boost in 1139, when the Pope issued a proclamation stating that the order was not subject to any local king or lord. They were not beholden to the secular laws of the land and only owed allegiance to the Pope himself. This unique designation from the Pope and the early support from one of the church's leading luminaries meant that the Templars very quickly grew in membership and prestige. As the organization grew, so too did their purview in the Holy Land. While the protection of pilgrims remained the primary goal of the order, this very quickly started to be interpreted as the general defense of Christian holdings in the Holy Land. The Templars started to take over castles and strongholds all over the Middle East. They had the manpower and the resources to defend these places, and so it seemed prudent that their management should go to the Templars. This aggressive expansion was not just limited to the Crusader states. In the decades after 1139, Templar houses started popping up all around Europe. From there, the Templars actively recruited people to join the order and head to the Middle East to defend the Holy Land. In moments where there was not an active crusade currently being supported by European kings, it was the Templars who kept a stream of European warriors traveling to Jerusalem. At their height, the Templars controlled over 1,000 fortifications and quote-unquote temples across the Holy Land and Europe. This eventually led to their development as an early financial institution, which I'll discuss in a little bit. As a military force, the Templars earned a reputation for being effective shock troops. They often bolstered Crusader forces with a hard core of well-trained mounted knights. Indeed, there were many times in the crusading era when the Templars proved to be the decisive factor in a battle. Many of the Muslim powers of the day came to regard the Templars as one of the most consequential forces in the Holy Land. Perhaps the most famous example of this was in 1177 at the Battle of Montesquieu. There, the Templars were key to one of the famous General Saladin's most notable military defeats. But As many of you know, it was only a matter of time before the Crusader states were ultimately wiped off the map by Saladin and his successors. Saladin took Jerusalem in 1187, turning the Crusader states into little more than a collection of coastal cities. However, the Templars would continue to be a going concern in the region for another century. The order would be instrumental in the somewhat successful Third Crusade. That was the one that featured our old buddy Richard the Lionheart. As you might remember, during Richard's famously poor incognito trek back home through Europe, the king apparently disguised himself as a Templar knight, donning the distinctive white tunic with the red cross emblazoned on the front. That is, of course, before he ordered roast chicken in a brothel and completely blew his cover. Oh God, I love that story. But in 1291, the city of Acre, the last Crusader stronghold, was conquered by a Muslim army, and the Crusader states were more or less destroyed. For most of the Templars' 200-year history, they had been a widely admired and celebrated group. Even as the Crusader states began to erode and fall to invading armies, the Templars were still in the Holy Land, faithfully holding the line. It seems as though most Christian Europeans saw the Templars as fighting the good fight. However, as historian Joshua Pryor has pointed out, during their final 50 years in the Holy Land, European public opinion seemed to turn against the Knights Templar. The military orders were increasingly being described as greedy and riddled with internal scandals and jealousies. Some Europeans found it frustrating that the Templars were willing to make strategic treaties with various Muslim powers. Some of their more zealous critics even went so far as to call this treasonous. When Acre ultimately fell, there were some who were inclined to blame the Templars and their brother order, the Hospitallers, for the disaster. After 1291, the Templars were still a large, wealthy, multinational organization who were exempt from taxation and any other secular law. They were able to justify this unique status for generations because of their ongoing work protecting Christian holdings in the Holy Land. But with all of those holdings now lost, many started to wonder why the Templars still needed to exist. Soon enough, the order would find itself persecuted and ultimately disbanded. So, let's take a close look at that process, because ultimately, the fall of the Templars is the source of so much Templar mythology. So let's check it out. The key to understanding why the Knights Templar have dwelled in our collective imagination longer than any other Crusade-era military order has to do with their sudden and dramatic end. It's notable that military orders like the Templars and their older cousins, the Hospitallers, managed to survive at all after the fall of Acre in 1291. When the final small European strongholds in the Middle East were done away with in the early 1300s, it would seem logical that the military orders would similarly vanish. Indeed, many began to publicly question the need for these military orders now that their main purpose, protect the Holy Land and guard pilgrims, seemed to have come to an end. But by the late 1200s, the Templars had become entrenched in European life. There were thousands of Templar brothers across the continent, and hundreds of Templar houses, castles, and other strongholds. Most importantly, they had become Europe's bank, before there really was a bank. So, how did this happen? Well, as we discussed, one of the big parts of the Templar mission was to keep both Christian pilgrims and Christian warriors from Europe excited about the Crusader states and motivated to make the journey to the Holy Land. This was done to hopefully swell the ranks of the Templars and other Christian forces who were almost always on the defensive after the First Crusade. If you were going to make the trek to the Holy Land in the 1100s or the 1200s, it was obviously a dangerous proposition. There was a high probability that you could be robbed or killed during the journey. Even if you made it to Jerusalem or one of the other Crusader-held territories, there is a very good chance that you would never return to Europe. So it became a common practice for a pilgrim or would-be Crusader to give all of their valuables to a Templar house for safekeeping. The Templars would also help you create a will and would act as the executor of your estate if you died while on crusade. So, if you were worried that someone was going to steal your stuff while you were away, or if you were worried that when you died, some scheming relative, local lord, or the king himself would try and claim your estate, the Templars could help you with that. If word got back to your relatives that you had died while in the Holy Land, they could then go to the Templar house, your will would be read, and your estate would be distributed to the right people. Perhaps even more importantly, if you made it back to Europe in one piece, your valuables would still be there waiting for you. One of the most interesting and thoroughly modern bank-like things that the Knights Templar provided was the medieval equivalent of a traveler's check. With the threat of robbery being what it was dangerous to travel with too much cash and other valuables. You could make a deposit at a Templar house in Europe and then be issued a special certificate. If you presented that certificate to another Templar house in the Holy Land, you could make a withdrawal for the amount that you originally deposited, just like a modern bank. Being that the Templars were an international organization with houses all over Europe and the Holy Land, they were uniquely positioned to provide this service. It also didn't hurt that these Templar houses were always guarded by armed men. Not to mention the fact that the Templars were a non-governmental organization. They held no allegiance to the local lords, kings, or any other secular authorities. So they could keep your stuff safe from them, and those people were always trying to get your stuff. This access to wealth meant that the Templars were one of the few organizations that could provide sizable loans during the medieval period. The Templars gave loans to lords, kings, and even the Pope on occasion. One of their most notable transactions came during the Second Crusade. The Templars ostensibly bankrolled the entire expedition when they gave the French king Louis VII a massive loan. That loan proved so difficult to recover that it nearly bankrupted the Templars. However, it began a long and often fraught financial relationship between the Templars and the kings of France. Louis's heir, Philip II, would so deeply entwine French royal finances with the Templar order that the Templars' base in the French capital, known as the Paris Temple, basically doubled as the royal treasury. Throughout the 13th century, this close relationship with French royalty seemed to solidify the place of the Templars within European society. But ironically, it would be this relationship that would ultimately lead to the downfall of the Templars. At daybreak, on Friday, October 13th, 1307, thousands of Templars in France were suddenly arrested by agents of the king. This massive group of warrior monks, who but the day before were considered among the most devoted servants of the church, were now being tried for heresy and a number of other bizarre crimes. So, what happened here? Well, to understand that, you first need to understand who the King of France was in 1307. His official title was Philip IV of France, but his reported good looks earned him the sobriquet Philip the Fair. However, he was better known for his unsentimental and often brutal policies. There is lots of historical debate around Philip's personal character. Some see him as a cold-blooded and ruthless king, while others claim he was merely a pawn manipulated by powerful advisors. Nevertheless, it's clear that his policies were aggressive, expansionistic, and hostile towards anyone who would undermine the authority of the crown or who caused problems for royal finances. In the course of his reign, Philip IV would embark on a number of expensive wars with England and the people of Flanders. This meant that the crown was perpetually strapped for cash and was known to go to extremes to both recoup the costs and get its various loans canceled. To give you some examples, in 1295, a bitter dispute broke out between Philip and the Pope at the time, a man named Boniface VIII. After his war with England, Philip decided that he was going to flex his kingly power and start taxing the revenues of the churches and monasteries in France. In the 13th century, this was a serious taboo. The church was supposed to operate independently of the state, so taxing the church was a big no-no. The Pope responded by flexing back and authoring a papal bull saying that all kings needed to ask his permission if they wanted to tax church property. This dispute was no small thing, as it opened up a huge can of worms about where the power truly lay in Europe. Can kings do whatever they want in their kingdoms, or does everyone bow to the Pope? Well, Philip IV appears to have been a kings can do whatever the heck they want kind of guy, and the conflict escalated to the point where Philip the Fair was running a full-on smear campaign against Pope Boniface. Boniface had attempted to put his foot down when it came to the issue of papal authority, when he convened a synod, or church meeting, and issued a statement in 1302 claiming that all power, both temporal and spiritual, came from God, and therefore flowed through the Pope. In other words, the Pope is top dog, and don't you forget it. Philip responded by calling a meeting of his own, where he proclaimed that he didn't have to listen to the Pope, because the Pope was a heretic. A heretic being someone who is baptized but does not believe in the orthodox teachings of the church. It's a pretty bold thing to say that the Pope is a heretic. Philip went a step further and accused the Pope of a number of scandalous crimes, including fortune-telling, sodomy, and, here's the best one, having an indecent relationship with a demon who lived inside of his ring. Man, I wish I had a demon ring. Anyway, apparently the demon would pop out genie style and would advise the Pope in all matters. These claims were pretty outrageous and were generally unsupported by any kind of evidence. But they were enough to galvanize the Pope's enemies against him. Eventually, things got so bad for Boniface that he literally had to run for his life. Another notable instance where the King of France accused his enemies of crazy stuff came in 1306 when Philip expelled an estimated 100,000 Jews from France. Once again, the crown was strapped for cash, and France's Jewish minority was about to help him balance his ledger. Now, of course, at the time, this wasn't advertised as a base cash grab. Instead, much like the Pope before them, the Jews were accused of witchcraft, the desecration of Christian symbols, and various plots to defile things holy to the Christians. Once again, Philip was presenting himself as a defender of the true faith in the face of a dangerous threat. Now, there's some debate among historians about how much this expulsion was motivated by pure anti-Semitic hatred and how much was just a cynical play for money. It seems to have been a bit of both, but the financial motivation was undoubtedly very important. As the BBC explains, quote, "All the Jews' belongings were auctioned. The king took the proceeds. All debts to the Jews were transferred to the king, and he received the payments from their Christian debtors. In order to maximize the profit, the king made sure the sale happened at the same time that a new edict forbidding coin clipping came into force. Endemic in the Middle Ages, coin clipping involved shaving off a tiny part of the precious metal of the coin and melting the collected clippings down to sell. Philip also offered a bounty of 20% to anyone who discovered any wealth that the Jews had secreted." End quote. So, this particular combination of policies, I think, makes it pretty clear that the king was looking to make some money. I think it's particularly notable that all the debts Christians formerly had to pay to Jewish moneylenders now had to be paid to the king. Wouldn't he just forgive the debts if this was truly about protecting French Christians? I mean, come on. Now, why do I bring this up at all? Well, I think this gives us some very important context when we consider what happened to the Templars. The king seemed to hate it when people challenged his authority and when they messed with his money. If he wanted to get that money, he had no problem accusing his enemies of all sorts of crazy crimes. Philip the Fair wasn't above stirring up ethnic hatred against France's Jewish community just to help balance his books. This is a man who accused the Pope of having an evil spirit living in his ring because the head of the church got between him and his taxes. In 1307, the French crown owed an enormous debt to the Knights Templar. So, what should we think when on Friday the 13th, out of nowhere, the Knights are accused of worshipping a severed demon head? Now, it could be a coincidence that all of Philip the Fair's adversaries were blaspheming demon worshippers. Or, perhaps, we're starting to see a bit of a pattern here. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when you will hear the second part of this Our Fake History special presentation. Because this is a special presentation, I'm going to hold off on my usual round of shoutouts that I do at the end of the show. Don't worry, I will be shouting out everyone who has decided to subscribe on Patreon when I come back from my all new episodes. In the meantime, you can still get in touch with me. Send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. Hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory. Follow along on Instagram at ourfakehistory. Or find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. The theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.